Now on News Talk, as part of our spring season of documentary on News Talk, producer Fergal McCarthy visits South Sudan to explore the continued efforts of Irish missionaries working there after it gained independence from the North in 2011 following a brutal civil war in South Sudan 101, Education in the World's Youngest Country.
This is Loretto Boarding School, an all-girl boarding school in South Sudan. The school is located on the edge of Rumbek Town, the capital of the Lake State. It's run by the Loretto Sisters of Ireland. It's the only school of its kind in the region. A girl's education is a rare thing in these parts, which makes the success of this school all that more impressive.
I'm Orla Tracy. I'm from Bray, County Wicklow. My family background is a lot of movement, a lot of travelling. I was actually born in Carlow. I spent a short period in Dundalk and Tralee. I went to primary school in Ennis, and then I went to secondary school in Loretto in Bray. So it was in Loretto in Bray that I met the Loretto Sisters. And while I was a student in the school, finishing school, I had a strong desire to be a Loretto Sister. The town that we're working in is a town called Rumbek. It's the capital town of the state, Lakes State, aptly named because of the water and the lakes that are around the state. It's right in the centre of South Sudan. When we came, South Sudan didn't exist. It's just become a new country since 2011. So we've just celebrated our fourth independence. But we're nicely situated right in the centre of the country. The capital city is Juba. And Juba is about 500 kilometres away, but given our roads, you would take it 2 days to drive, or it's a 1 hour flight to get to the capital city. In 2004, the Loretto Sisters in Ireland, the Loretto Sisters worldwide, started a new movement called Courage to Move. And it was an invitation for all the Loretto Sisters in the different countries to start a new mission, to re-engage with this missionary spirit that we had in the early foundations, and to try and start a new mission in a new country. At the time, there was an Italian bishop in this diocese in Rumbek, and he was looking for a congregation, an educational congregation, that would run a girls' boarding secondary school in Rumbek. So we came in 2006 with the intention of starting the girls' boarding school. Like all good things in South Sudan, nothing goes according to plan. When we got here, we were brought on a tour of the compound, and we were shown the convent, which was actually lower than the foundations, and we were told that was the house. And like the great Italian bishop that he was, he said, "No problem, sister, it'll be ready by Easter." Easter. It took 2 years. It took 2 years for it to be ready. So during those 2 years, we were based in the parish, which was great, really, because it gave us a chance to learn something about the people and the culture and to know some of the challenges.
Once the construction of the school and the convent was complete, the sisters could finally begin the work they had come here to do.
So we started with the secondary school. We started with two classes, with 35 girls. Now, 8 years later, we have 183 girls in boarding school in secondary school. And these are girls coming from within the state and from surrounding states as well, from different areas. They live with us pretty much like the Irish school timetable. We have 3 terms in the year. We have a break. The summer holidays for us are Christmas, January, because of the weather. And they can go home every midterm if they want, if their families are close enough, depending on what's happening, or they stay here with us for the midterm breaks. So the secondary school is 4 years. It's a four-year program. And the girls live here with us during the 4 years. I mean, they live here, so your home environment, they have their food, they get 3 meals a day, they get their videos on a Saturday night. They cultivate. One of the things, an income-generating project they do, is they all dig, they all farm. And the idea is that they're supposed to produce some of the food that they eat as well. The other thing that we're very strong in is that they take leadership roles. The government has the affirmative action where they give 25% of all government positions are supposed to go to women. The difficulty is that most of those positions are occupied by women who make tea or who sweep, because we don't have a 25% of the population educated women to take those positions. So from an early stage when the girls are here, we try to give them responsibility, whether it's looking after their class, whether it's looking after equipment, whether it's looking after the farm, whether it's looking after the animals. They might be looking after the young students in the primary school. They might be responsible for measuring the food, for organising the dining room, whatever. I think we have quite a number. It's a prefix system, but it's more than a prefix system as well.
Starting in a new school can be a daunting experience for anybody, not least for a young girl in South Sudan. In order to help with this transition, the school actively incorporates some of the local culture.
Within the African culture, that sense of mother and extended family is very strong for the girls. Here we have, in Dinkaland, we're very strong in a polygamous society. So many of our fathers would have 5 wives, 10 wives, they could even have 50 wives. And the extended family is very strong for the girls. So when the girls come to the school, we try to model that as well. When the new student comes, she probably hasn't had any female in her family who's ever been to a boarding school or who's ever been to a school. So she's the first girl. Now, you don't want to be complaining the first day the girl arrives into the school, because you know she hasn't a clue. So she gets a mother. A senior 2 student becomes her mother, a senior 3 student becomes her grandmother, and a senior 4 student becomes her great-grandmother. And within that family, she has aunts and cousins. This is the new school family, and they each take responsibility for looking after the new student. If the new student can't settle, we don't call the new student, we call her mother, the senior 2 student, then we call the second year student, and we ask the mother, what's the problem with your daughter? And then she'll be the one to tell us, and if she can advise, she'll advise her daughter, and if she can't, then she'll get us to try and help her.
With the secondary school up and running, Orla and the Loreto sisters then looked at the possibility of opening a primary school.
Good morning, our teacher. Teacher, we are ready. Good morning.
So about 4 years ago, we started a primary school for the boys and girls in the local community. So that's the project that's going on down below. We now have 10 classes. We have just under 500 students, boys and girls from the local community. And they come every day for class in the morning. And they also get fed every day. And then in the afternoon, we also have, for the older children, these would be children maybe who didn't get a chance to go to school at a younger age. They come for what we call accelerated learning. So there's a special program where they can do 2 years of primary school in 1 year. And the idea being that you try to make them more age appropriate so that they can join mainstream school then in the afternoon and the mornings.
Our class is ready, teacher. Good morning, our teacher. Teacher, we are ready. Our class is ready, teacher. Good morning.
I actually felt very drawn to the idea of coming and working in South Sudan. I had never been to Africa. I didn't know anything about the life of a missionary as such, but there was just some attraction to it. That was 10 years ago, and I'm still here. So I'm not quite sure how to articulate it, except to say that I feel very much at home. There's a massive challenge every day. There definitely is a God thing in it, because I just think the whole mission that we have here is just one big miracle after another. If you were to tell me 10 years ago, what was ahead of me, I probably would never have packed my bags to come here. I probably would have stayed at home and been very happy. But it's been a great journey, and it's great to see the girls grow, and it's great to see the school grow, and it's great to see the development to continue, though unfortunately we are seeing the country turning into more and more chaos as time goes on.
Sudan's President Salva Kiir declared a state of emergency in parts of the country on Wednesday. Crisis began when President Kiir sacked his deputy Riek Machar, along with most of his cabinet last July.
These are South Sudan's rebel fighters, the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition. The fighters are tired but upbeat. They've been fighting forces from the government in Juba for about 18 months now and say their mission is to change the leadership. This commander tells his troops.
The school gets ready to break for midterm. It's often during these breaks that the issues of the outside world affect the students most. Aside from the ongoing civil war and the inter-clan fighting in Rumbek, there are also the issues of forced marriage and a continued skepticism of the importance of a girl's education.
Good evening once again. We have come to the end of our first part of the semester, of the term. I would like to congratulate everybody for all they did in making the term, this part of the term, successful. We are headed to an important period when we got our independence. And as Sister said at the beginning of the week, this is a very sensitive time. We've noticed what has happened previously. We don't want to lose any of you when you're out there. There is a bit of insecurity outside there. Remember the security drills that you have done, the emergency drills that you have done. In case of anything, ensure that you are safe and show your siblings and your family how to behave in situations of emergency. And most importantly, take care of yourself.
I just add and say, please let them see that you're serious. Please let them see you well disciplined. You know all of this yourselves. So we look forward to it. It's always a great occasion. It's our fourth independence. It is not a great year for us in the country. Diesel and petrol are problems. Market prices have doubled and tripled in price. So don't expect to come back with the same big bag that you came the last time with. You hear it? We have many troubles going around, and you know all of that. So as Mr. Carey says, we are saying it's a sensitive time for you. It's a very sensitive time in the community as well. So please be mindful. Please be careful where you go, who you go with, and what you're doing. And be careful of all of that. So just be sensitive to demands on families as well when you go out there. It is not an easy time. Let's go in peace. Let's stay in peace. Let's come back in peace. Wonderful.
Right. That's before you break off.
As much as the school might try, it's hard to shield the students from the realities of life outside. South Sudan is one of the world's youngest countries, a country that's gone through an awful lot in recent times. In 2011, the country finally gained its independence from the north, emerging from decades of conflict, widely regarded as Africa's longest-running war. After gaining their independence from the north, the country soon deteriorated into civil war. The two main protagonists are the two largest tribes of South Sudan, the Dinka tribe and the Nuer tribe. The government forces are mainly Dinka, and the rebels are largely from the Nuer tribe. Forces that once fought side by side in the War of Independence now find themselves pitched against each other. Aside from the ongoing civil war, Rumbek town and surrounding area is also plagued by inter-clan fighting. This is Dinka versus Dinka, and the school struggles to escape any of these issues.
Within Rumbek town then, we're living with the Dinka tribe. They're very tall, beautiful, graceful people, very dark. And within the Dinka tribe, there are many different clans. So when you go around the town, you can even identify the people. They mark their foreheads in different ways. In Rumbek town, it's the Dinka Agar, and they have a number of parallel lines. So the young men, very often you'd see them with their markings like that. Yeah, the different regions, within the Dinka tribe, there are many different sub-tribes. So the different regions have their markings in different ways. We might say in the different counties, they have different markings. So in a nearby county, they have markings where the lines point downwards. Another one, they kind of have curved lines, shape lines, and they have different styles of them.
Although these traditional tribal markings are as beautiful as they are visually striking, for a youngster in Rumbek town, these tribal markings can be a matter of life and death. Because of this, many families have stopped marking their children in this ancient traditional way.
When we came in 2006, Sudan was a united country, and we were under the leadership of the north of Sudan. But a peace agreement had been signed in 2005, which allowed for a referendum. And that referendum allowed for the possibility of South Sudan becoming a separate state. Thankfully, the referendum did take place, and 99.5% of the population in the south voted for separation. So we got separation in 2011. It was fantastic. It was just an incredible experience to be here and to see the joy and to see the excitement and just that whole sense of liberation that the people were experiencing. I suppose the reality is it was a huge high and we had to come down. And unfortunately, we've been coming down ever since and we're getting lower and lower every year. When we came in the beginning, everything was about Omar al-Bashir and how bad he was and how bad the regime in the north was and how the people suffered. Now, when we started talking about independence, people had that dream that life was going to be better, that maybe there was going to be an instant fix to all our problems, that we're going to have better roads, better infrastructure, we're going to have jobs, we're going to have money, we're going to have security. Now, of course, we all know that things don't get fixed immediately, and I think many of our countries, and Ireland included, we suffered from our own struggles of independence after as well. South Sudan is no different. I would add and say it's even worse because we don't have an educated class. We don't have an established civil service. Few of our men were educated and were in positions to manage the country. Most of the men were soldiers and they would have got their training in the bush. And even our president was a brilliant soldier who had worked in the bush and fought in the bush for years. Now, all of a sudden, he's been brought in and told you're the president of the country. So to change us from a fighting community, a fighting nation, into a civilized working democracy overnight, I don't think anybody can expect that. And I think that we did. I mean, many of the people here thought that that's what was going to happen. It was going to be a quick fix. Our great president Salva Kiir was going to give us beautiful roads within a year. We're all going to have jobs and we're all going to have plenty of money. The reality is, I don't think that can happen anywhere. I mean, I don't think anybody can expect that anywhere. There is also a question of ethnicity, and it's something we don't really have in Ireland. Okay, we have it when we're playing GAA and whose county and whatever you're following, but we don't really have it in the same context of Africa. In Africa, we have, in South Sudan, we have a lot of tribes, and people identify themselves with their tribe. So our president comes from the biggest tribe within South Sudan, which is the Dinka tribe. His vice president comes from a different tribe, which is the Nuer tribe. And there has been a lot of history and a lot of trouble between the two men and between the two tribes. And while the president did his best to appease the vice president or whatever the politics are, they didn't fit well together. And the vice president was not happy that there was no progress. And of course, as he voiced his opinion, many people would have agreed with him that we didn't get the quick fix. We didn't get the roads within a year. We didn't get the jobs within the year. And he had a good audience who would agree with him and say that the country didn't develop as well and as quickly as we wanted. And as a result, obviously, the politicians were divided, ethnicity got in the way, and a civil war broke out. And it started in December 2013. Who started, who's to blame, who knows? I mean, everybody has an opinion about it. He's responsible. I'm sure both are responsible in their own way and both are guilty in their own way. But the reality is that it has brought a war back into South Sudan. South Sudan has oil. And you know, wherever there's oil, there's often tension and trouble. And a lot of that oil is around the borders between the north and the south. From the fighting in December, it very quickly spread to some of the oil towns. And it's there that most of the fighting has dominated. Around the border areas, the fighting has continued over the last 18 months, I think, at this stage. What it means for us in Rumbek is that it means that guns are available. And every young man now has a gun. We have always had a problem with our young men and guns. We've always had a problem with our young men and their cows and guns because we have a big culture of revenge. So if you have a gun and you have a young man and he's not happy, what is happening every day and every week in Rumbek is that the young men are taking the law into their own hands and they are killing one another. I think over the last 5 days, we've had three significant fights from three different directions, and over 50 people at this stage have been killed in those fights. I mean, it's increasing and it's coming from different areas. But the difficulty is, how do you take the guns out of the arms of the men when the young men also fear that the civil war can also be brought to this area? So how do you protect us and at the same time defend us and all of that together? It's a very difficult situation.
Before the girls can finally enjoy their break, they have one last task to complete. Tomorrow, the school is marching in the local Independence Day parade. There's a heavy military presence about town, and the atmosphere is a little tense.
For those who have the camera, you are not allowed to use your camera. If you want to use your camera, please come to us, and then we will consider you. لمن تجي بالتلفون بتاعك وتستعمل التلفون ده فوربيدن نانا بنعتبروك انت مخالف
Although security is tight, the parade somehow manages to create a carnival atmosphere. After all, this is the biggest day of the year. Amongst the endless noise of the numerous military bands, the Loreto girls fight to be heard. But if you listen hard enough, you can just make them out.
You're listening to South Sudan 101, Education in the World's Youngest Country, on News Talk 106 to 108.
With the school closed for midterm, we visit another Irish-funded project in the area. In Akol Jal, an area about 15 miles outside Rumbek, the Jesuits run an agricultural school for the local community. In Dinka culture, it's the tradition that women tend to the crops while the men look after the cattle. The aim of the project is to provide agricultural training that complements local farming practices with techniques from the developed world. The goal of the project is to allow the community to become self-sufficient with regards to their food needs. It also creates a source of income for the women, while reducing poverty throughout the community. Father Richard O'Dwyer from Dublin oversees the project.
So I went to South Sudan to work for the Jesuit Refugee Service. I did that for 4 years. And my main area at that time was building schools. That was one of my main tasks. But I also got interested in a bit of agriculture because I noticed people spoke about their gardens rather than their farms, and they were working in the country. So people were only cultivating small plots of land. But in my last year, the provincial, who's in charge of all the Jesuits in East Africa, he came up to see me and he said, you know, he knew that the JRS project after 4 years was coming to an end, and he said, would you like to stay here and work for the province, the East Africa Jesuit province, as against the refugee service? And I said, what would you like me to do? And he said, would you go to Rumbek? We're starting off a farm and an agricultural college there. And I said, well, my background is construction. I mean, I've done a little bit of agricultural dabbling, you might say. But he said, I've heard you've done a good job, so would you try this for a few years anyway? So I agreed. And in Rumbek, the predominant group are the Dinkas, who are basically cattle keepers. They're not really farmers as such. They don't till the soil. But they had asked the Jesuits to help them because the local chiefs and the local people wanted to learn farming because they realized there's probably a future in farming if you can get the basics right and learn the basics well and move away from just purely keeping cattle to do real farming, producing food and crops, because the Dinkas don't really eat the cattle. It's like their bank account, it's their wealth, and there's polygamy among the Dinkas, which is quite common, and you have to buy your bride, if you like, or your wife to be, through giving maybe 100 or even 200 head of cattle. So over time I got to know people like a veterinarian in northern Uganda who helped me enormously, you know, to help people to work with cattle for ploughing, ox ploughing, and we also did beekeeping, and we got people seeds because seeds were very hard to get, so we brought those in from Uganda. So there's 7 of us in the community. There's 2 of us involved with the college and the farm, but unfortunately we haven't been able to do much in the way of staying out at the farm because there's been a lot of, sadly, there's been a lot of Dinka on Dinka clashes between different Dinka groups. Our farm is located at the border between Rumbek East and Rumbek Center, and these two groups have been killing each other and stealing and looting from each other, cattle and goats, etc. And that has created a serious problem. You're also probably aware of that. But we wanted to get something.
Father Richard oversees the project with his Polish colleague, Father Thomas Nogaj. Thomas will be showing us around. The road that we take to the agricultural school runs right through a contentious area, a division line between 2 warring Dinka clans, where only yesterday there was a lot of fighting.
And let's go straight there, okay?
Yeah.
And then come back as soon as we can. This is the difficulty here. The situation is quite dangerous today because it seems like on the other side of the main road from Juba to Rumbek to Irel, there is a big fight and people expect some sort of revenge even on our side. But we're going to do a quick run, you know, back to the farm just to see how people are there and our belongings, and then we'll be quite soon back.
Just the advice is to leave everything, you know, in Rumbek, our belongings and money and cell phones, because it's quite dangerous. We just don't know what to expect.
In order to avoid the fighting, Thomas decides to avoid the main road and instead takes a dirt road that winds its way through the bush. Because of the conflict, the area is littered with houses that have been abandoned, local people that have instead opted for the relative security of Rumbek town centre.
Why an agricultural school? Well, the local people have asked for this. They asked the Jesuits, and the local people and the chiefs gave us a site of around 120 hectares or 300 acres, to build the school, the agricultural school, and also perhaps to build other things like a clinic for medical treatment of local people, and also kind of a kindergarten school or a nursery school to give children, the local children, a good start in their education, because many children are out of school and it's not easy for children to reach the town. It's a long distance of 12 kilometres if they'd have to walk, really. So we've started off working mainly with the local women who are growing kind of local vegetables like kale, or kusuma wiki as they call it, and they also grow pumpkins and one or two other green vegetables. I suppose to be something like our own version of cabbage, but we're trying to encourage them to diversify into things like tomatoes and eggplants, and just to give a more balanced diet for them. And the main other crops that they grow would be maize and sorghum and millet as kind of staple foods. I think it's a bit too hot there for Irish potatoes, but I'd love to experiment a bit. And as we'd also like to introduce poultry and pigs again, just to give people a bit of variety and some more skills and just more choice, I suppose, in regard to what they eat and how they nourish themselves and their families. And we're also looking at the possibility of buying a tractor and a plough and a harrow, because the ground has never been ploughed and it's very compacted. It's like almost not quite as hard as concrete, but it's a bit like that. So in order to do the initial ploughing, I think it would be good to use a tractor, and then we can maintain that in a more sustainable way with the use of oxen and an ox plough and a little bit of digging with hand, weeding, etc. But we're trying to be as green as possible. We don't intend to use any artificial fertilizers or to but to use things like animal manure and compost especially, and to really respect the environment. I mean, the climate there really is almost like perpetual summer, and it averages around 35, 36 degrees, so it's quite hot. Sometimes it goes up over 40, but not very often. But without forcing the land too much, you could probably have two growing seasons. I think to have three, you'd really have to use a lot of artificial fertilizers and inputs, etc. And I think that would be too much for the land. We'd prefer perhaps to try and grow naturally in the rainy season, and then in the dry season there's a lot of water in the ground. We're using currently a solar pump and storage tanks to help the women grow their vegetables even in the dry season. And we've been growing some things like tomatoes and eggplants and one or two other vegetables like onions and carrots ourselves. So we're in the early stages. It's a big undertaking. At times it seems daunting, but if the security situation improved and people saw the value of just taking the gun out of the country and just trying to live in peace and work things out through dialogue and reconciliation, I think the country would really be able to go forward.
The farm and compound are impressive. A huge area of a couple of hundred acres of land. Richard and Thomas have fenced off a dozen acres for the agriculture school. The compound is full of rows and rows of fruits and vegetables, has a number of chicken coops, a tree nursery, four or five greenhouses, a couple of beehives, and plenty of grazing land for the livestock they'll soon be adding. Back at school, midterm is now over and the girls are checking back in for the new term.
Let me see your nails.
Aside from the usual checks of uniform, hair, and nails, in Loreto, there's always the chance that one of the pupils has been caught up in the inter-clan fighting during the break.
Rachel, where did you stay? Any problems? Did any of you get that fighting? None of you, thank God. Any problems so far? I've just joined. Any problems so far, Nelson? Sick. How many? Sick?
So far, I think we have three.
Any problems of insecurity?
Not yet at the moment.
We won't know for about another hour or two to know what's going on. Yes, Sora will give us the update. What's happening?
How are you?
How is the life?
Very
good. Any troubles outside?
No.
Nothing caught you?
Nothing.
And the market, how are the prices?
So bad.
So bad. Yeah. Did you do your shopping?
No, I did not do anything.
Because there is nothing. You see now, when I start saying there's no biscuits, you people don't believe me when I tell you the prices are terrible. We used to give them biscuits in the mornings, but now they're three times the prices. Now Sora's coming back with nothing because she had no money. Welcome. How are we doing?
Good.
Welcome back. How are we doing? How was the holiday?
Were your people affected by that fight?
Did you hear it?
Yeah, it was terrible.
When was
it? It was the day before yesterday.
It was Saturday evening or what?
Yes.
What did they say?
Bad.
It is the same fight that's going on with Pachong or what?
Yeah, no it is not Pachong. It is Bentuwencha, Dukan and Patir. Bentuwencha, Dukan and Patir.
The same thing over and over again?
It is just different people. They are fighting with so many groups. But they are just neighbors. But I don't know
They are Rumbek East and Rupert, what?
And they are neighbors, maybe three miles, four miles.
Very near, they are just
four
neighbors.
4 miles from Chuaichok to Fetir.
Anyway, welcome back. We'll try not to shoot here. We'll tell them to give him a break. Salome is coming from another part of Rumbek town, where there was a lot of fighting on Saturday evening. So she was saying that when she was at home, that they were really disturbed by the fighting. So the brother is explaining that they are two neighboring clans actually. They're about 4 kilometers apart, 4 miles apart, he's saying. And they were fighting over the weekend. It's just continuous. Any direction you go, you'll find that they're fighting. So she's very happy to be back and hopefully no more fighting. Sometimes you'll find they're all affected. So sometimes you just keep the questions general and just, if they volunteer, then you'll get it.
The girls continue shuffling in, and the stories of fighting over the weekend go from bad to worse. Like all schools, some of the girls are naturally shy. But when one of the girls is extra quiet, Orla and her colleagues begin to worry.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? You didn't enjoy it? Five days of holiday, you did not enjoy.
Was there fighting in your place?
Yeah.
Where were you?
Chuebet.
Was there fighting in Chuebet as well?
Yeah.
This girl's family was caught right in the thick of one fight.
Okay. Sorry.
Were your people affected?
Yeah.
You lost a few?
She lost all her uncles.
All your uncles?
Yeah.
Five.
The girl lost 12 uncles to the fighting over one midterm break.
Okay. Sorry. Welcome. How are you doing? Hey, that's a different fight now. That's another fight in a different county. She lost many of her uncles. To the one we were discussing earlier, it was the one in the other side of Rumbek. This one is a different county side. Yeah. There have been 3 different fights over the last 4 days. 5 days. Oh, I'd say over 20. Over 20 people killed. There were 9 with the one in Rumbek town. Then there were 5, the one with Rumbek county, which is the next county of Rumbek East county. And then there were about 15 on the side of Chuebet, another county. So over 20 people killed. And now they are waiting for revenge, so it's expected that the number will increase because there'll be more fighting as the people revenge those. But that's 3 different fights in 3 different locations over the one midterm break. And that's not including the small little fights that's going on and the individuals that are killing each other. That's just 3 major fights. I think we should have another midterm break, guys. Recover from that last midterm break.
Yeah.
God help us. Welcome.
Thank you.
How was the holiday? I'm afraid to ask any more questions.
Let me see your nails, Mackenzie.
Aside from the worry of the girls being caught up in the inter-clan fighting, during the midterm, there is also the worry of forced marriage. During these school breaks, the girls return home to their families and tribal clans. As has happened before, it is during these breaks that some girls have been forced into arranged marriages, never to return to Loreto or school again. Forced marriages are an integral part of both Dinka and South Sudanese culture. In Dinka society, teenage girls are routinely sold to the highest bidder, willing to part with the greatest number of cows. Once all the students have checked in and the classes have resumed, Orla and the teaching staff notice that one of the girls has not returned. They fear the worst. Orla tries to get an idea of what has happened from the girl's cousin.
Now, I want to hear the what we're going to do about it. And I'm not sure we can do anything at this stage.
We can not do anything because now they took her to Juba yesterday.
Okay. One of the challenges we have in the school are students who are taken by forced marriage. So that would be a case where the family, maybe the father, the uncles, arranged in the girl's absence her wedding. If she goes home for midterm break or if she goes home for school holidays, that's where she runs the risk of being forced into marriage. Last night when the girls came back from their midterm break, there was one definite story of one student who had been forced to marry. Her stepsister is actually in the school and she's the one giving us the account, so we know for a fact that it's true. This particular girl is only in the school 3 months. She's a senior one, like a first year student. She actually had a visit from her father about 3 weeks ago. Yes. The father came one night with four men, and it's highly unusual for such visitors to come to the school. So as soon as we saw the men coming into the school, alarm bells went. And we went out, I smiled sweetly at the father, and I explained to him that he was welcome, but that we didn't need to see all these extra men. And as I say, alarm bells go as soon as you see that, because you know that there is some question as to why the men are coming. Maybe they're coming to look at her, maybe they're coming to question her, maybe they're coming to see. We spoke very sweetly with the men. We told them that they were welcome, but obviously we didn't expect them to be having any conversation with the girl. They understood. They were very polite. The father met the girl for a few minutes. When we asked afterwards if things were okay, we were told everything is okay. That the father had just come to tell her that her own sister had run away with a boy. But that there was no query over her being married and that everything was okay. Now, the girl herself went for midterm break and hasn't come back.
During the holiday break, the student was forced to marry an older man in his 60s who lives in the capital, Juba. She has already been flown out of Rumbek and it seems little can be done.
But it is the father or the uncle who is pushing this marriage?
Uncle.
So the father has no right? She is the first girl?
Yeah, she's the first in her mother's side.
Okay, and that's part of the problem too, because if she's the first girl, she's not the property of the father, she's the property of the uncles. So even though the father signs a commitment form that he will allow the girl to stay in school, he doesn't have any right over that girl. It's one of the great difficulties here. The firstborn girl in every family usually is denied a chance of education. If she starts, they'll force her out, and it'll be the uncles more than the father who'll force her out. When the mother married the father would give cows to the girl's mother. But the father wouldn't be able to pay the dowry alone, so he gets all his brothers and his relatives to contribute to his wedding. So, for example, if the girl is married for 60 cows, as in the case of this girl, or 160 cows, the man might only have 10. And then he'll get his uncles and in-laws to contribute as well for his wedding. The man has to repay the cows to his extended family. And if he can, he'll do it over the years. But most of the men don't manage to pay back the cows. So when the girl matures, and when she starts menstruation, the uncles then start coming looking for their cows. And they will say, the girl can be married now because we need our cows back. If the father has means, he can give his own cows. But if the father doesn't have means, then he's forced to follow the word of the uncles because he's in debt to them. The first girl is considered the dowry. So whatever the father borrowed, it's through the marriage of the first daughter that payment is cancelled. So the first girl is always vulnerable. The second girl tends to be freer because the debt has been paid by the marriage of the first girl. And some of these first girls can be married at 14, 15 years of age, 16 years of age. And that would be the normal situation here. Now, what can we do?
The War of Independence, the ongoing civil war, the ever-present inter-clan conflict, forced marriages, polygamy, and the continued skepticism of the value of a girl's education. As much as the school might try, it's hard to shield the students from the realities of life outside. Loreto acts as a sanctuary for all of these issues, a free and empowering safe haven for these young girls.
Sit, relax, enjoy. Here comes the great question. What shall I offer my country? What shall I offer South Sudan?
We were talking about the life of a Dinka woman within Rumbek. It's not an easy life. The women are generally not considered equal. They're not considered people to have a voice or an opinion about their lives. It's a hard life. From a very early age, the girl is brought up to, in effect, to be the slave to the family members. That would be the word some of the girls would use here. So the girl from a very early age has been inducted into the works. They're taught from a very early age to look after their brothers and sisters, to cook, to collect firewood, to cultivate. The women are the ones doing most of the farming work. I wouldn't say the men's life is easy. It's different, but there are huge expectations on men as well. From a young age, the boys, when they go out of school here in the afternoons, they go home and look after the cows and the goats. And dare a cow or a goat enter into the neighbour's field and eat the crop, the boy is beaten, and badly beaten, because it's something taken very seriously in the community. So it's not easy for the men or the women, and the boys and the girls in particular. It's a hard life. They're the ones that you're seeing in the school are the survivors. I mean, they say that there's a more likelihood of the girl dying before the age of 5 than finishing primary school. I mean, that's a terrible statistic. So you're seeing survivors, whoever you're meeting, and they're tough, because they've had to survive. And it's amazing to watch them when they come to the school in the beginning. They're hard. They life is hard for them. And then they get into the compound and they begin to relax, and you can actually see their whole body begin to relax over the weeks. Then they go home for a weekend like they've just done, and they come back tense again because they've been living beside fighting, or because they're hearing about death, or because there's so much sickness and poverty and all of that around them. And it's a tension for them. So coming to school and boarding school is like, it must be the equivalent of going to Disneyland. That sense of you're just free. You can be a child, you can play games, you can be happy. And you don't have the burden of all that responsibility and work that you have at home.
Hard work, I promise. Peace, I promise. Patriotism, I promise. Thank you.
South Sudan 101, Education in the World's Youngest Country, was produced by Fergal McCarthy. Narration by Audrey Hamilton and sound supervision by Sean Hurley. The documentary was supported by a grant from Mission Cara. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.